From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The North Carolina State Senate voted 32-16 today in favor of repealing the state's controversial House Bill 2. HB 2, among other things, required transgender people to use the bathroom corresponding to the gender on their birth certificate in public buildings. The bill will still need to pass the state house, which could happen this afternoon, and go on to get a signature from Democratic Governor Roy Cooper in order to become law. Now, critics say this new bill doesn't go far enough. And at stake are the economics of the state, in part stemming from a pending deadline before North Carolina loses the ability to host NCAA basketball championships. Joining us now from the State House is Jeff Tiberi, Capitol Bureau Chief at Here and Now, contributor WUNC. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Jeremy.
So this bill has passed the Senate. Is it likely to pass the House and become law?
I think there's a good chance that it passes the House. Speaking with both Republican and Democratic lawmakers and some staff members, it sounds as though they have the vote. It also sounds as though it could be pretty close. Right now, we're about an hour into floor debate. That could extend for another hour or two. And one of the concerns that some of the staffers have is that the longer the debate goes on, the more fervent and vociferous some of these lawmakers, you know, they make their case. Do they potentially move anyone or sway anyone? Right now, it looks like this would pass the House. And for comfort, those that would like to see this passed would like to have a vote sooner as opposed to later.
But this bill is not what you would call, I guess, a clean repeal of HB 2. There are some criticisms that say that this is not the right approach. Tell us about those.
Certainly. So this is not a standalone bill per se. It's not a brand new piece of legislation. There was a piece of legislation that was already sitting in the Senate, and they did what we call around here gut and amend. And they amended it with a three-part proposal. The first part repeals House Bill 2. That, as you mentioned, is the notorious, infamous bathroom bill that requires people to use the bathroom corresponding with the sex listed on their birth certificate. So part one of the proposal repeals HB 2. Part two is a preemption on bathrooms. Layman's terms, localities, municipalities cannot, you know, issue laws that pertain to bathrooms. All of the laws about bathrooms would fall under state jurisdiction. Then part three is a moratorium on non-discrimination ordinances. So the city of Charlotte or Raleigh or Durham would not be able to pass any protection of its own until 2020. And that is, I think what LGBT advocates are most upset about is that kind of extension of what would be a limit on passing what we call NDOs.
But the governor and the proponents of this bill seem to think that this would be enough to convince, let's say, the NCAA to back off a little bit?
They do. They feel that this would most likely appease the NCAA, and the NCAA, of course, a major player in college athletics, the player in college athletics, will be naming championship sites soon for a number of sports from 2018 through 2022. North Carolina lost college basketball earlier this month, and they're hoping to get some of those games back with this proposal.
That's Jeff Tiberi, Capitol Bureau Chief at WUNC. Jeff, we'll be watching. Thank you.
Sounds good. My pleasure, Jeremy.
Let's go now to the Northwest, where the traditional territory of the Native American tribe called the Senaikst spans a wide swath of northeast Washington state and southern British Columbia. Never heard of the Senaikst? Well, that may be because Canada declared them extinct decades ago. But the tribe has now been officially recognized in Canada, thanks in large part to a Washington state man with Senaikst roots who just won a landmark court case. The Northwest News Network's Emily Schwing explains.
Outside the provincial courthouse in Nelson, British Columbia, more than 50 Canadian and American tribal members gathered to celebrate a court victory that affirmed a connection to their historic homeland. They hugged each other and threw their arms in the air. Many cried tears of joy and relief as they listened to a traditional honor song. The case took nearly 7 years to resolve. It took provincial court judge Lisa Mrozinski 2 hours to read aloud her judgment. It acquitted Rick Desitel of illegal hunting north of the U.S.-Canada border. Desitel's a member of the Senaikst tribe from Washington state. Like many of his relatives, he was born and raised on the banks of the Columbia River on the Colville Reservation.
And one of the big things that I wanted to get the invisibility of me erased, and so I can come back here and have some input on things that are happening in this country to save a lot of the history that's still here.
In 2010, Desitel crossed the 49th parallel to hunt for elk on the traditional hunting grounds of the Sinaixt tribe in Canada. It's the only Indian tribe the Canadian government has deemed extinct. After more than a century of conflict between the Sinaixt and miners, loggers, and other white settlers, the last remaining Canadian Sinaixt member died in 1956. But many others moved or were forced south into Washington state. Between 3,000 and 4,000 Sinaixt live on the Colville Reservation today. They're also known as the Arrow Lakes Band.
I think we've been waiting, hoping, praying for this day since 1800s, probably.
That's Michael Marchand. He's the chairman of the Confederated Tribes of the Colville. He's also a Sinaixt descendant.
I know I was raised by my ancestors, my elders, and they talked about how we need to do this, and I've always felt this day would come. It's just a matter of when, and it's here.
According to the decision, when Desitel crossed the U.S.-Canadian border to hunt in 2010, quote, he was exercising an Aboriginal right of the Sinaixt people to hunt in their traditional territory, as they had done for several thousand years, unquote. The judge pointed to historic evidence that indicates the Sinaixt were prolific hunters, and they may have been forced out of Canada. The judge's ruling means Washington's Sinaixt members can now hunt in Canada with minimal restriction. Attorney Mark Underhill, who represented Desitel in the case, calls it a landmark decision.
So the Sinaixt exist in Canada now.
Yeah, and that's something that may sound a bit, a bit trite to say, but it's that profound. Because for practical purposes, they were considered to be extinct. And so now there's a clear statement by the courts of this province that they exist.
Underhill says he expects an appeal from the British Columbian government. So far, BC officials have not responded to repeated requests for comment. As for Rick Desitel, he says he hopes the decision will result in more consultation between the Canadian government and native tribes. He says he looks forward to hunting again in Canada. For Here and Now, I'm Emily Schwing.
And we want to quickly touch on news that's sure to reverberate, that Santander, the bank, has to pay $26 million in a settlement with Massachusetts and Delaware over its subprime auto loan lending practices. Yes, it was subprime home loans given to people who couldn't afford them with interest rates set to explode that caused the housing collapse. These Santander loans are car loans. Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey said the bank gave them to more than 2,000 people just in Massachusetts from 2009 to 2014. Deirdre Fernandez is a business reporter for the Boston Globe. And Deirdre, explain, what was Santander accused of doing?
So basically, they were accused of or alleged that they had dealerships that were basically inflating incomes of people to get them into loans, inflating the value of the cars. And they even had identified a list of fraud dealers that were essentially marking up incomes of car buyers.
Is this going to extend beyond the two states that were in this lawsuit?
Yeah. So basically, this is something that a lot of other agencies have been looking at. The Justice Department subpoenaed a bunch of companies a few years back, including Santander. And the Attorney General, Maura Healey, here in Massachusetts, is hoping that this settlement provides a blueprint for other states and other agencies and regulators looking at how auto financers basically have been conducting business.
Look, it's the same issues that came up during the housing crisis. A lot of people were outraged. They said it's the people's fault. They know what their salary is. They know when they can't afford a car. But we understand that some of this money in the settlement is going to the car owners to help them pay those loans?
Yes. So some of it is. It should help, in some cases, eliminate the outstanding loan for some of the buyers. And if you talk to some of these people, they say, you know, they go to these car dealerships. You're provided with a whole list of all these options. The prices change as you're talking to the dealership. And some of them said they were confused about what they were buying and weren't checking.
Easy to understand if you've ever been to one. Well, so how much have... Can you give us an example of how a loan might have inflated because somebody defaulted and then the interest rate kicked in? How big are these loans?
Well, I mean, the examples I have, both of the folks bought cars that were around $20,000 and some of the interest rates on them were like 20%. So you can imagine people buying cars that they're still paying off in some cases that aren't worth as much anymore. I mean, the value of cars go down as you drive them. So in some cases, they're worth a few hundred dollars and they have loans that are $10,000.
Wow. And that'll be covered. So is there a sense that other banks and other car loans might be being looked at as we speak?
Yeah, definitely. I think the AG here said that they're continuing their investigation into dealerships and also finance companies that provided auto loans.
By the way, the producer of this segment just pushed down the little toggle we have and said in my ear, my interest rate was 3. So 20. That's amazing.
That's amazing, yeah.
Yeah. Deirdre Fernandez, a business reporter for the Boston Globe, thank you so much.
Thanks for your time.
The Senate Intelligence Committee took charge today, holding hearings on Russian interference in the U.S. election. The House Intelligence Committee's investigation has been bogged down in controversy over its impartiality. We're joined now from Bloomington, Indiana, by two former lawmakers, one Republican, the other a Democrat. Former Republican Senator Richard Lugar chaired the Foreign Relations Committee. Senator, welcome.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
And we're also joined by former Congressman Lee Hamilton, who chaired the Intelligence Committee in the House. Congressman Hamilton, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. A pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's great to have both of you. And Congressman Hamilton, let me start with you, because that Intelligence Committee has been in the news a lot recently. Do you think Chairman Nunes should step aside and let somebody else take over this investigation into Russian interference in the election?
Well, I think the Russian interference in the election is a very serious matter that needs to be looked at very carefully by truth seekers, by people who are independent and rigorous in their investigation. What Russia has done goes to the very heart of our system. They're trying to weaken it, and we need to investigate it carefully. My own personal preference would be an independent commission here. I am not impressed that the Congress is sufficiently united to do a careful job, so I would tend to go towards an independent counsel or a commission. It seems to me the partisanship is very high in the Congress, and the chances of getting a decent result not very high.
Senator Lugar, do you agree with that? Do you think there should be an independent commission?
Yes, I do. I agree with Lee. I think his analysis is very right on.
Hmm. Why do you think there needs to be an independent commission? Do you think that Chairman Nunes has not done his job well here?
It appears to me that he is attempting to protect the president, that he is attempting to get into the White House and to have these situations that are not acceptable if we're really going to have confidence in an investigation. And so I wish that he would step aside.
You got to think of the product you want to produce. If you're going to have an impact as a commission or any investigation, you're going to have unanimity. You're going to have bipartisanship. And you're going to have a report that is either unanimous or very close to it in order to really impact. If you split 5-5 or whatever, no matter what the split, the report ends up on the shelf.
Whether or not it is found that there's any coordination with Trump associates and Russians, if it is found in this investigation that Russia did what all the intelligence agencies think it did, which is try to influence our election, try to hack into our election, what should the response from the United States be?
Well, first of all, we ought to establish just exactly what we believe they've done. And then we should respond very strongly that this is totally unacceptable and that we really are not prepared to tolerate this type of interference.
There are two investigations here, at least. One is what I consider the paramount one, the one that Dick referred to, that's the investigation of what the Russians did. That's serious stuff. The other investigation is the ties of Trump aides and allies to Russia. That's an important investigation, but in my mind, not as important as the first one.
Let's talk about foreign affairs more broadly, because you're having a conference right now at Indiana University. What do you think, and I'll start with you, Senator Lugar, what do you think are the biggest challenges for the U.S. right now when it comes to foreign policy?
Well, first of all, we need to be considered a global power that is interested in international affairs. I think that's become a debate in a sense of the administration, but if we're going to be a global leader, then we really do need to have people who are really well-versed in the affairs of all of the countries we're going to deal with. because they're counting on us to have a fleet at sea that keeps the sea lanes open. Well, I would hope that we keep foreign trade going strong, that this becomes a very, very big part of our situation. I would hope we have a flow of persons, both Americans who are going abroad. I know that 3,000 Indiana University students are going abroad this year, despite the risk, and people coming to the United States. In other words, we need to be stressing internationalism, globalism.
But isn't that the opposite right now of what we're doing with the Trump travel ban, which, yes, has been stopped in the courts, but that's what he wanted to do, the wall with Mexico?
Yes, it is opposite to that. This is why I emphasize very much the fact that America's role in the world, and that's what we're discussing here at Indiana University now with the Global International Studies School, is something that all of us need to be thinking about. We live in a vital world. We need to think about climate change in that sense, that we're all on the same planet, and we must be observant of how we can work together, whether it's the Paris Agreement or other agreements down the trail.
Congressman Hamilton, what about you? What do you think are the biggest challenges in terms of foreign policy right now?
Well, I think Dick said it spot on. It's American leadership in the world. You know, I think we believe, Dick and I believe, that the world's a better place because of American leadership. We're not perfect by a long shot, but we try to do the right thing, try to improve the quality of life for people. There's a lot of question in the world today about American leadership. We've got to reassert it. We've got a lot to offer the world, but we're not doing it to the extent that I would like, and I think Dick would like as well.
Well, next week, President Xi Jinping from China is going to visit the United States. He's going to spend some time with President Trump at his resort in Florida. Senator Lugar, how should the U.S. be approaching China right now, do you think?
We should approach China as a great nation that has really very strong economic growth and very considerable trade ties with ourselves. But I hope they'll also discuss North Korea and the fact that we need to work with China to try to disarm the North Koreans from ideas about developing nuclear weapons. This could terrorize the entirety of Asia, quite apart from the possibilities of missiles reaching the United States. And this is a good time to see if we can forge a relationship with China that would be comparable to that which was forged with Russia and China, for that matter, Great Britain and England, and the Iran deal, as we worked our way toward postponing, at least, any developments of Iranian nuclear power.
Congressman Hamilton, you obviously had experience, as we all know, on the 9/11 Commission. As you look at the fight against ISIS right now, first of all, do you think that that sort of grew out of our fight against al-Qaeda post 9/11, but also how do you think we're doing in the fight against ISIS?
Well, it certainly did grow out of it. What you're confronted with is a large number of people who have deep-seated grievances, who don't like the United States, don't like all we stand for. So we have to be prepared, whether it's al-Qaeda or ISIS or whoever follows them. We're not going to solve this problem easily. How are we doing? We're doing pretty well on the military side. We've set ISIS back very considerably. I think the broader question, it's fundamentally, of course, a war of ideas. And we've got to up our game, not just in terms of the military response, but the broader response involving propaganda, information, the battle of the war on ideas, and all the rest. I think this is a long-term struggle. And we've better get ourselves engaged in using all of the tools of American power and ingenuity and creativity to fight ISIS and what comes after ISIS.
I want to finally ask both of you, and you're from two different parties, and people actually listening to this may be surprised to hear that a Republican and a Democrat can agree on so many things, but how do each of you rate the Trump presidency at this point, starting with you, Senator Lugar?
I believe it's the beginning of the presidency, and that certainly a certain degree of tolerance ought to be given as the president begins to find out what the responsibilities are. He does not come really to the office, in my judgment, very well prepared to handle international relations, for example. But he may improve upon that. So I'm willing to at least let some time pass and to hope that we see better results.
Congressman?
I think he's off to a rocky start. If you look at the headlines for the last 100 days or so, they're all on internal problems, some self-inflicted by Trump himself. What we're not doing is we're being distracted from dealing with the problems that are urgent, not just in this country, but abroad as well. So I don't want to see Trump fail. I want to see him succeed. It's not in my interest as a Democrat. It's not in my interest as an American to have an American president fail. But I really think the problem he has had so far is a major distraction from attacking the problems at home and abroad that we need to be focusing on.
That's former Congressman Lee Hamilton and former Indiana Senator Richard Lugar, who are hosting a conference right now on foreign policy at Indiana University in Bloomington. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson, and I want you to take a minute right now to think about the people you love. Have they ever listened to a podcast? Do they even know podcasts exist? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media. And if they don't know how to download a podcast, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a whole new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag Tripod. That's hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks. And if you flash back to the 2016 campaign, we were hearing a lot of this from then-candidate Donald Trump.
I think NAFTA has been a total disaster.
NAFTA was the worst trade deal in the history. It's like the history of this country.
And if we don't get a better deal, we will walk away.
So he's talking there about the North American Free Trade Agreement. And according to a new draft proposal on NAFTA, the Trump administration is now moving towards only modestly changing NAFTA. Joining us for more is Michael Regan, senior editor of Bloomberg News. He's in New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So this draft was first reported by the Wall Street Journal, but tell us more about what exactly is in it.
Right. So the Journal and the Washington Post and the New York Times, a few others, are all reporting bits and pieces of this memo. And the reason why it's so significant is that in order to renegotiate NAFTA, the White House has to formally notify Congress of plans to renegotiate a trade deal 90 days before it actually starts doing that. So the circulation of this draft really suggests that they're getting very close to that stage where they're ready to start the negotiation process.
So what would be kept in and what would be taken out of NAFTA?
So the reporting on the letter indicates that the White House is not looking to get rid of these arbitration panels. And these are sort of controversial part of NAFTA. They allow companies and investors in the three nations to circumvent local courts when they're settling civil claims. The draft reportedly talks of seeking to improve these procedures rather than eliminating them completely. And there's something really notable that is not included in the draft, and that is any discussion of policies that countries use to influence the exchange rate of their currencies, which is a very hot topic that Trump has brought up a lot. And I think a lot of people were expecting that to be included in these negotiations.
So after all of that rhetoric that we heard, you know, it's a disaster, it's the worst trade deal in the history of the United States, does it sound like it's going to, if the Trump administration gets what it wants, it's going to change significantly or just a little bit?
Yeah, it's widely being reported as a softening of his stance, and that's probably true. But there are some very significant changes that are discussed. One of them, and this is what the Times is focusing on, is the idea that countries would be allowed to reinstate tariffs on the other nations if a flood of imports from those countries was threatening the domestic industry. You know, obviously, we've heard a lot. Trump talk a lot about the auto industry being affected this way. So it opens the door to the so-called border adjustment tax on imports, which is a very controversial thing.
Right.
And that's one of the biggest changes, I think, that this draft is talking about.
Have we gotten any reaction from Canada and Mexico to this draft?
I have not seen any official reaction yet, but I got to say, you know, my guess is that, you know, the officials in those two countries must have watched the healthcare bill and the lack of success with that. And my guess is that that probably emboldened them a little bit to push back harder against these changes than they maybe would have otherwise if it looked like Congress was going to fall in line behind President Trump.
Interesting. Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The bodies of two UN workers were discovered in Congo this week. 34-year-old Michael Sharp, a Mennonite from Kansas, and Zaida Catalan of Sweden went missing about 2 weeks ago, along with their Congolese interpreter and drivers, after entering rebel-held territory as part of the UN group of experts tasked with getting rebels to come home. We want to take a minute to remember Michael because we know a little about him. In 2015, Michael was with the Congolese Protestant Council of Churches in their Peace and Reconciliation Program. NPR's Gregory Warner met him then and filed this story.
I met Michael Sharp on a commuter boat crossing Lake Kivu in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Not far from the lake were rebel-held forests where every few weeks Sharp would walk, unarmed, to the base of a particularly fearsome rebel group called the FDLR, and there he would sit in the shade of banana trees to drink tea, practice his Swahili, and listen to these rebel stories.
You can always listen. You can always listen to people who want a chance to talk about how they see the world.
Sharp was working with the Congolese Protestant Council of Churches in their Peace and Reconciliation program.
We try to build relationships and just interact. The more we interact, the more they trust us to turn themselves into us.
Sharp is being a bit modest here. His church group persuaded some 1,600 fighters, it's about a quarter of the force when the program started, to put down their weapons and exit the forest that they'd occupied for two decades. Now, in a minute, I will tell you the magic words that this group used to accomplish this apparent miracle, but first, I need to make room for a story that the rebels tell about themselves.
Do you hear me?
Anna Hedlund is an anthropologist at Lund University in Sweden.
Let me just fix this sound here.
I called her on Skype because she did her field research in a remote FDLR rebel camp.
It's far away from everything.
Away from markets or farms.
Yeah, the living conditions are really difficult. Or most of them want to go back to have a normal life. But it's also difficult because many of them don't know what a normal life is or what it means because they grew up in the forest.
How they got to the forest is the troubling part. The original founders of the FDLR were some of those who committed the 1994 genocide in Rwanda. They were part of the Hutu militias that killed Tutsi civilians. Then when the Tutsi army came, many Hutus were pushed out over the border from Rwanda into eastern Congo. And there, they harbored the intention to return to Rwanda and take over.
They practice the language. They teach the children how to dance Rwandan dances. They have Memorial Sundays where they kind of recreate the memory of Rwanda.
Were you surprised to encounter such homesickness?
Yeah, that was one of the most surprising things, actually, that they tried to prepare and to be ready for the day when they will return.
This homesickness is what you might call the weak spot that Michael Sharp and his Congolese colleagues learned to exploit. One of those colleagues, Emmanuel Kambale, speaking French, tells me and my interpreter exactly the words that he would use to convince these former killers to go back home.
Vous avez déjà 50 ans.
You, Kambale would say, you're over 50. It's too late for you to take over Rwanda, but your children are growing up unschooled in the bush.
Maintenant, l'enfant ici qui sera le Rwanda de demain.
Don't you see that your children, who is the future of Rwanda, when he goes back, he's going to be the slave of those who are there.
Parce qu'ils n'ont pas étudié.
Because he's illiterate.
That's it. Those are the words, spoken over trust-building cups of tea, that have resonated with hundreds of rebels. Maybe because, like any diplomat or real estate agent, Kambale is aligning incentives. He's telling the rebels, while you're in the forest standing your ground, that ground is slipping out from under you, because time is against you. If you don't give up now, your children, your children's children will suffer, will be slaves. Back on the boat, Michael Sharp points out that this negotiation strategy is not only more effective and less bloody than military campaigns, but it's many times cheaper.
This program operates right now on $12,000 a month.
But even that shoestring budget, once supplied by the Norwegian government, had been suspended. Sharp thinks the money got redelegated to Syria. And this commuter boat ride was actually Sharp's chance to rescue his program. While he and I were talking in the stern of the boat, the bow was occupied by VIPs from the U.S. State Department, including Special Envoy Russ Feingold, who reports directly to John Kerry. But just walking those 10 feet to bend an ex-senator's ear proved almost more intimidating to Michael Sharp than walking into the rebel-held forest.
Fundraising isn't generally in my job description, and I'm not an expert fundraiser, so I don't really even... We'll see.
Michael Sharp in 2015 with NPR's Gregory Warner. Michael's body was recently discovered along with a colleague's, both killed in Congo. Greg Warner joins us now. And Greg, this must have been a shock to you. Sounds like a lovely young man.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I still remember him on the boat, talking to me, more interested in talking to me than approaching Russ Feingold and making his pitch for funding. But he did finally make that pitch, wasn't successful. And so he ended up, and I was talking to him throughout, he ended up going to work for the UN, which is when he died.
Yeah. Still tell us more about this kind of work that he was doing, because he first explained it to you, this idea of understanding that these fighters they were trying to lure out and away from the fight were relying on some sort of mythical sense of the way things used to be.
Yeah. And it's so important. Michael would have turned 35 this year, so we don't know where his career might have gone. But and we certainly know he was very committed to Democratic Republic of Congo. But I do think, and he had talked about how these ideas really apply to more than just Congolese rebels. There are so many violent groups out there today that are sustained and do recruitment because of a myth about how the past used to be. And it is a myth about some good old days that never really existed. But then it portrays the militant who's doing violence as a kind of defender of the purity of the past, which then justifies or legitimizes so many bad acts. So his feeling was you don't need to get people to give up their myth. You know, that's the last thing that people can give up because that sustains them. Just talk to them, figure out how to reach them, get them out of the jungle or whatever kind of exile they're in. And then later on, that myth can be dissembled. You don't have to get people to admit they're wrong as the first go because then you're not going to get anywhere.
Right. And he told you that he thought he could apply this to other groups.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He believed that this could apply to ISIS, he mentioned Israeli settlers. You know, he felt that any group that was insular and had a feeling about the past that they thought was true and they wanted to redeem or they wanted to turn back history and create again, he felt that there are ways to reach them. And it starts with just not making them admit they're wrong as the first go.
Yeah. And he thought he could even speak to neo-Nazis this way. He had plans for the future. Look, just briefly, the region that he was in, what is the conflict?
So the conflict's actually changed a little bit, or I should say it's gotten a new development of late. So you and I have talked before about Democratic Republic of Congo. This conflict's been going on for 20 years. It has different factors, the rich mineral deposits, a lawless country, various international actors in Africa and elsewhere. But more recently, what's happened is that the president refuses to step down. Joseph Kabila, he's been in power 16 years. He took over when he was 29, when his dad died. And basically, he says that the government can't afford new elections. That's his excuse. This actually may be true. The government's kind of broke, but, it's not an excuse for not transferring power. And so the new fault lines that have been created on the tinderbox of Congo have been really a domestic fight between pro-president and anti-president. And that's the front line that Sharp and Catalan were entering into.
His colleague. Look, do we understand that he would just walk into the jungle unarmed to talk to fighters?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. I think he would even, if he was here, he would say, God, Greg, you're making me sound like such a mythical creature. He would say that mostly it was his Congolese colleagues that did the walking. I know that he himself did a number of walks. But I think the key thing about that journey, I mean, even the region he was in when he died,
it's not accessible by road. So it's only accessible by walking or by, in this case, motorbike. So he went in with his motorbike riders. It's the only way to meet with rebel leaders. And that's what his aim was.
Yeah. That's NPR's Gregory Warner speaking about Michael Sharp, the American from Kansas who was killed along with his colleague Zaida Catalan. They had gone into rebel-held territory in the Congo, part of the United Nations group of experts. Michael Sharp was 34 years old. Terrible loss. Greg, thanks for helping us know him a little better.
Thanks for taking the time to remember him.
Here's a shocking number. 65% of the U.S. prison population is addicted to drugs or alcohol, and only a fraction receive treatment in custody. A few jails and prisons have turned to medications like methadone or Suboxone to treat prisoners addicted to opioids. But those drugs come with challenges of their own. That's why some prison drug programs are trying something different, as Here and Now's Dean Russell reports.
It's just past noon at Barnstable County Correctional Facility in southeastern Massachusetts. Roll call.
11, 12, 13, 14, 15. With 30 on deck, all present and accounted for, sir.
Each inmate appears from his cell, head up, hands clasped behind his back in a military-style pose. They're all part of the jail's special residential substance abuse treatment program, called RSAT.
You know, the inmates that are in the RSAT program are in their own separate housing unit.
That's Sheriff Bill Cummings. For 18 years, he's led the program to get inmates off drugs and alcohol.
They dress differently. They're not in jumpsuits like the other inmates in the facility are.
They're also treated differently with behavioral therapy and drug education. It's a big job. And so in 2012, Sheriff Cummings took a leap and started one of the first programs in the country to offer a unique form of medication, the drug Vivitrol.
Vivitrol is an injection that lasts for a month. And what it does is it deadens the receptors in the brain that give you the euphoria from drugs or alcohol.
Vivitrol isn't like the traditional opioid medications methadone or Suboxone, which are taken every day. And as narcotics, they can be abused or even sold illegally. Not so with Vivitrol.
First of all, it can reduce cravings, particularly for alcohol, but also slightly for narcotics.
Dr. Warren Ferguson is director of the Health and Criminal Justice Program at the University of Massachusetts.
More importantly, the other thing it does is it will prevent anybody who uses narcotics to actually get high or significantly reduce the high. And perhaps most importantly of all, it will prevent overdose and death.
Dr. Ferguson's working with Barnstable County Jail and other correctional facilities to study opioid treatments. He says medicating inmates is taboo, but shouldn't be, especially because inmates are far more likely to overdose in the first weeks after they're released.
Abstinence alone does not cure addiction. People need treatment.
It's almost like training wheels. If you really want this and you're ready, this is it right here.
Inmate Jermaine Jackson is just days from getting out. A 40-year-old father of four, he spent much of his adult life abusing alcohol and drugs, including heroin. Jackson's just completed his second attempt at Barnstable's RSAT program. The first time, he didn't use Vivitrol. He later relapsed and was arrested for trying to steal a TV for drug money. He completed the program again, and this time, he's asked for Vivitrol. For him, it's a safety net once he gets home.
A lot of my friends seem like they're dropping like flies. I don't know what I'm going to be walking out to. I don't know. Maybe I relapse, and there's some heroin in front of me. I don't know. But I just want to have this as an extra safeguard.
But Jackson knows Vivitrol is no wonder drug. His younger brother Corey was also recovering from opioid addiction. He'd been prescribed Vivitrol by his doctor, but after 8 months, or eight doses, treatment stopped.
And my brother had to, in turn, went back to using heroin. And he subsequently overdosed June 10th, 2016. Right at the beginning of my sentence.
A study in the New England Journal of Medicine shows the effects of Vivitrol tend to wane after treatment stops. Alkermes, the drug's manufacturer, offers the first dose free at some jails and prisons. But at $1,300 a shot, maintaining treatment isn't cheap. That's why a lot of inmates rely on Medicaid. Peter Katujan is sheriff of Middlesex County Jail, about an hour and a half north of Barnstable.
Before I became sheriff here in Middlesex, we would, as people were leaving the facility, we'd hand them a packet so they could sign up for their own Medicaid.
Katujan's Vivitrol program assigns social workers to help in the transition out of jail, making sure the largely poor, drug-addicted inmates can continue treatment at low or no cost to them. 90% of the inmates that finished the Middlesex program were enrolled in the state's Medicaid.
Those that get out that have coverage of insurance, especially for that, including mental health and substance abuse, they have a 33% lower rate of recidivism than those that don't have health care.
Without Medicaid, the program would likely crumble. Back in Barnstable County, inmate Jermaine Jackson is feeling sluggish but hopeful after his first Vivitrol shot. Soon, he'll be on the outside with the memory of his brother Corey to motivate him.
He was a big outdoorsman, loved building houses, working with his hands. I don't know, man. I miss him a lot. I just want to make him proud. That's all.
And with a little help, Jackson's confident he can do that. For Here and Now, I'm Dean Russell.